Sit down, princess. Susquehanna Judiciary, come to order. Today is Wednesday, March 11th, 2015. We're going to go out of session, open a public hearing on House Bill 2612, and ask Representative Kenneman, please. And you can, yes, Nikki.
And so, Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2612 is sponsored by Representative Kenemer at the request of Bennett Johnson. We don't have the paperwork back on this yet. We have no amendments before us today. House Bill 2612 mandates that mass transit districts resolve disputes over accident fault involving mass transit district vehicles by binding arbitration. It states that defendants possess a constitutional right to a jury trial if the amount or value claimed is over $750, unless the defendant is a public body and the amount claimed is less than $5,000. House Bill 2612 changes the notice of claims requirement to 360 days from the alleged loss, injury, or violation for all actions arising under the Oregon Tort Claims Act.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Vice Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Bill Kenemer, State Representative, District 39. Thank you for the opportunity to be here on behalf of House Bill 2612. I put this bill together at the request of the Johnsons, who own Fearless Brewing out in Estacada, Oregon. And they had an incident with a TriMet bus, and they will talk to you about that. And out of that incident, they had concerns about the way these kinds of claims are adjudicated. And there seem to be issues of equity and fairness, and I think they can make their case better, much better than I can, so I'm going to let them do that. One other thing I would like to add is I appreciate a number of people have been making their way to our office to talk about what we would consider unintended consequences of our bill. I think there are some needed amendments. At this point, I'm not quite sure, but I appreciate the opportunity to start talking about this because we want justice and fairness to prevail, and that's what this is. So with that, I'd like to introduce Bennett and Ken Johnson, please.
Representative, you need to get to another meeting.
I think if you don't mind, I'm just going to sit here for a minute because I'm interested in how this proceeds and hearing what all is said.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Chair Barker and Vice Chair Olson and members of the committee, my name is Bennett Johnson, and this is my husband, Ken Johnson, and we own Fearless Brewing Company in Estacada, Oregon. And thank you very much for having us here today. This bill is about fairness, and through this bill, I'm trying to level the legal playing field in disputes between large government agencies with large legal resources and small businesses and private individuals. When small businesses or private citizens file a lawsuit of $5,000 or less against a government agency in small claims court, my bill requires the government agency to utilize small claims court to resolve the dispute and restricts the agency from opting for a jury trial. In July of 2013, I had a dispute with TriMet, or our company had a dispute with TriMet, after a TriMet bus collided with our company truck. So I filed a claim with TriMet, and they denied it. They're self-insured, which is important here, and they alone make the determination whether or not to accept or deny claims. TriMet has a widely held reputation of denying claims and waiting to see what comes back in litigation. So if two private insurance companies have a dispute, they can generally settle it in front of an intercompany arbitration board quickly and inexpensively. But since TriMet is self-insured, they're not members of that organization. So I asked the TriMet claims adjuster why my claim was denied, and I was told that TriMet would not disclose that information. So I filed a small claims suit in Multnomah County. And in small claims court, if a claim is for more than $750, the defendant can request a jury trial, which throws the case out of small claims and into circuit court. Now, if private companies or individuals opt for a jury trial, then we all have to lawyer up and spend money. But agencies like TriMet have their own legal departments. And I did ask an attorney about this case, and I was told that if we decide to pursue it with an attorney, that TriMet would probably ask for endless depositions and continuances until I spent a lot of money and finally ended up crying uncle. So I've been asked why I didn't refer this matter to my insurance company, and again, this had to do with fairness. I was convinced that we were in the right and that TriMet should pay us, but I was advised that my claim was too small for my insurance company to actually argue it, and that they would pay for the damage to our truck, but then they would raise our rates as a result. I've also been asked why I did not try and find an attorney to represent me on contingency. And if I'd been able to talk an attorney into taking a small case like this on contingency, which probably is unlikely, then I would have had to pay a third of the award to the attorney. And I've also heard argued that ORS 20.080 reduces the risk of legal fees for smaller claims. My understanding, and I'm not an attorney, but my understanding of that statute simply allows the winner to request legal fees to be paid by the loser, which means I could end up paying both my legal fees and the fees of the defendant in the event that the defendant decided to countersue me. So I could end up paying double fees. Finally, I'd like to address the economic impact issue of this bill, which you may or may not have seen recently. Right now, private citizens and businesses have a year to make a claim, but in the case of government, a claim must be made within 6 months. The estimated economic impact of extending the limitation to 12 months for government was about $600,000. If changes were to occur to my bill, I suppose it could be argued that government agencies are a bigger target for fraudulent claims than individuals, private citizens. I'm not entirely sure that I agree with that, but if there was a change to my bill, probably that would be the place to look. However, the other estimated economic impact was $125,000 based on more claims being won by plaintiffs as a result of going to small claims and not being able to opt for jury trial. And what I think that really means is that government is able to outmaneuver small guys like us, and to the tune of $125,000, and it's an economic impact that I believe probably ought to be paid. I think it's important to point out that my opportunity or our opportunity for restitution has come and gone. This is no longer about my claim, but rather I'm here as a result of it. I'm here to try to level the playing field for the little guy in the future and really instill a sense of justice in this. After many letters to the TriMet Board of Directors, TriMet Legal Counsel did offer me half of what they thought my claim should be, not what half of what my claim actually was. And I refused to settle, and I decided to try a different tact and change the law to the benefit of those who may find themselves in my position in the future. I don't think government should be able to use the resources paid for by taxpayers against taxpayers. And small claims court is an unbiased and competent forum to settle small disputes like these quickly and without a lot of expense. It would probably save government a lot of money just to go through that rather than argue it out, you know, in a larger legal system. I think that approach is really fair. It levels the playing field between all of us. And I'd really like to thank Representative Kenemer for providing me this opportunity, and I want to thank all of you for listening to my testimony.
Any questions? Anybody? I'm not sure. So on Oregon civil law, if you can force anybody into small claims court, or don't they have a right to, doesn't any civil case have a right to a jury trial in Oregon? I'm not.
Are you asking me if anybody can sue anybody in small claims court?
If you want to go to small claims court, and even if it's $500, and I go, it's a civil case, I want to go to a jury. I'm not going to go to small claims court.
If it was $500, my understanding, again, I'm not an attorney.
I'm not either.
But my understanding is that if it's $500, it would be under that $750 cap, and therefore you would have to argue it in small claims. If it's over $750, that's when you can opt for the jury trial.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions from anybody?
Do we have anybody else who's going to testify?
About there, yeah. Mr. Chair, if I may add, the claim that they had was in the general vicinity of about $3,500.
Maybe $3,000, yeah.
$3,000 to $3,500, just to give you a perspective. And, of course, the timeline for that is past. But there's an equity issue that that the Johnsons are looking toward.
Okay, Representative Post. I do have one. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have one. I'm glad that you, in the written and your oral testimony, that you said this, because I think it's important that it doesn't sound to me, because this was 2013, right?
Yep.
2612.
No, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. 2013. I'm sorry. Yes.
This is not. I'm trying to go after TriMet, those big bad guys. You're looking at something grander, bigger, larger scale. Is it?
Absolutely.
Right, because the time frame, actually, when I had filed my small claims, by the time we'd gone back and forth with letters and everything, I was right up against that 6 months. And so the time has come and gone for our claim. There's nothing that we're going to be awarded. This is simply to prevent this kind of experience for other people in the future.
Okay, great. Thank you. And the bill, if I'm not mistaken, moves the figure from $750 to $5,000. I don't know if you said
right. That. If it's $5,000, if it's $5,000 or under, I will say that every year small claims courts, or every few years, they increase the amount that's actually allowed in small claims. Small claims in Multnomah County at the time that I filed this was $10,000. I think that there's an argument that could be made that it should be to the limit of small claims. But at the time, the reason I selected 5,000 was because that was kind of the ledge where an insurance company, my insurance company, if I had filed a claim for damages to my truck, they might actually argue it with, I mean, they might find it worthwhile to argue.
Any further questions? Thank you very much, and thank you, Representative.
Okay. Thank you.
Kimberly Sewell, Eric Von Hagen, and Steve Lippold, please. You can go in any order you choose, but please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Kim Sewell. I am the Director of Legal Services at TriMet. Our department handles 95% of the litigation for TriMet. Seated next to me is Mr. Van Hagen, who is also an attorney with TriMet's legal department. Thank you for allowing us the opportunity to share our thoughts on this bill. With respect to Section 1, which mandates binding arbitration to establish a fault for all accidents involving a mass transit district, the concerns we have with that mandate, one, it eliminates for all parties the right to have a jury hear the controversy and decide the issue. That's been a long valued, it's the foundation of a fair judicial system to have a jury trial. It is also inconsistent with the Oregon Tort Claims Act under 30 ORS 30.265 sub 2. That provision, the Oregon Tort Claims Act, is the sole cause of action for torts against public bodies. it would force claimants into binding arbitration when the incident may involve a vehicle from a private entity. That would create some issues that would be difficult to deal with as the provision is written. It establishes no arbitration process. It has no limitations on what claims would be subject to this binding arbitration, so from, you know, $100 up to thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's also inconsistent with the Section 2 part of the bill, which discusses public bodies and small claims cases, because if a public body is a mass transit district, it would be subject to binding arbitration, so it arguably wouldn't be in small claims court. And it also ends up resulting in serial litigation. You would have a binding arbitration process that everyone would be required to go through that would simply establish fault. There would obviously be a subsequent process, likely on all of them, to establish damages. So you would have serial litigation. With respect to Section 2, which is the small claims provision, which a public body cannot opt out of the small claims case on controversies of $5,000 or less. Again, the concerns I would share with you about that are it eliminates the right to have a jury hear the controversy, which, again, is a foundation of our fair judicial system. Significantly, also, the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure do not apply in small claims. And so it would deprive the public body and therefore the public of the opportunity to investigate the claims and to establish what the liabilities may be. There is no rule of civil procedure process that applies to a small claims case. So they would be mandated on every case to be in small claims. It also overlooks other avenues that are already in place to address the needs of a smaller claimant trying to seek redress against a public body. There are a couple statutes out there. In particular is ORS 20080. That is a statute that provides for attorney fees to any claimant who brings a lawsuit of $10,000 or less and prevails in the lawsuit. And so there is a provision out there that encourages the little guy to have access to an attorney to litigate their claims and provides for attorney fees for prevailing upon those claims. There's also binding arbitration through the court system, through the litigation system, through ORS. I mean, not binding, excuse me, non-binding arbitration through the court-mandated civil system through ORS 36.415, which, again, is a more economic way to litigate a case through the civil claims process. With respect to the tort claim notice, I think that there is some confusion that I heard about what is involved with tort claim notice. The provision that is discussed that is part of the Oregon Tort Claims Act, and I wish I had the actual ORS site. It's 30.265. Okay, under ORS 30.275, there is a notice provision to filing a lawsuit against a public body. All that requires is that a claimant provide notice of an intent to file a claim. It is not a limitation on when you need to file your claim. It is a notice provision. So a claimant has 180 days to inform the public body that they're intending to file a lawsuit. And then there's a statute of limitations that's established throughout the other Oregon revised statutes that would apply to when they actually need to file the lawsuit and in civil court. So there is no requirement that a party who is seeking a tort claim against TriMet file their lawsuit within 6 months. And with respect to the tort claim notice provision, it's part of the entire Oregon Tort Claims Act. It was a sort of part and parcel of the establishment of tort claims against a public body. So it's important to read the tort claims notice provision in the context of the entire Oregon Tort Claims Act. And there are already exceptions to the six-month notice requirement for circumstances like a wrongful death claim, or there's a discovery rule that applies to the notice provision. So again, I think it's important to first understand that the notice provision is not when you need to file your suit, it's just when you need to provide notice. And there are exceptions to that for circumstances already in place. I'd also note that there was a rework of the Oregon Tort Claims Act fairly recently in 2009 when they looked at the entire act, and there were no changes to the notice provision at that point in time. So those are the thoughts I wanted to share with you. I thank you for your time. Certainly, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Anybody have any questions? Okay. Proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Barker, Vice Chair Olson, Steve Lippold from the Department of Justice. I can't really say anything more than has already been said with, in large part, to 2612. The Department of Justice is not involved in the business of providing transit, so we're not interested in that particular provision. But we share the same concerns about the small claims court and the tort claims notice that were mentioned a moment ago. A couple of things that were not mentioned that I think is important for the committee to understand is that despite the comments of the proponents of the bill, this in a small person against a large organization, say like TriMet, Department of Justice, what have you, keep in mind that this bill is written also would apply to counties, cities, and much smaller public bodies, and would also impair their ability, number one, for a jury trial, or number two, to be able to use the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure to resolve a case perhaps by motion. The other concern that Department of Justice has is that we have a number of claims that come in from inmates in the small claims realm. We anticipate that with this particular provision, there will be an increase in those cases, and many of those cases are usually resolved by a motion. What we try to do, as indicated a moment ago, is remove the case into circuit court, and then under the rules of civil procedure, file a motion to dismiss, and we often resolve numbers and numbers of the inmate small claims cases in those ways. It's an efficient process for us to use as we go forward. So with those additions to what has already been said, I think the points have been made.
Okay, no questions for anybody? Hey, thank you very much.
No,
I'm sorry. Where's one more person speaking? I weren't going to.
No, no.
Okay. Then I do have a question. Okay, please. Thank you, Chairman Barker. I understand where Johnson's, I think it was the Johnson's.
Yes.
Johnson's, where they're coming from. I am far from being an attorney. Notice I look over there. I understand the whole point of I'm just Bill, and I have whatever limited resources I have, but I'm going to be in court with pick the agency, and they have in essence unlimited funding. I guess that I just want to make sure that we all understand that it's just the little guy taking on the big guy, and that is a popular theme over the last few years, and that's what I see in this bill, and I think there are amendments need to be made, possible some changes made. Again, I'm not a legal expert, but do you understand where they're coming from? And because I do, and I've been in a situation like this before, so.
Very much so, and again, I think that maybe I didn't do it eloquently enough, but I was trying to refer to the statute of ORS 20.080. I agree with you. I think that there is sometimes a lack of access to the court system because of the inability to get an attorney or the expense of an attorney. And I think if you look at that statute, it was designed to address that inequity and to allow those type of claims to be attractive to a plaintiff attorney to take because of the ability for them to there are restrictions in that where you've got to make an offer, and if you don't make an offer and they prevail and they get a dollar, they get all of their attorney fees with no limitation. I mean, you can tens and thousands of dollars. So and I will tell you, we see a lot of these 20.080 cases, a ton of 20.080 cases. It is doing the job it was intended to do. And it's for all those little claims. If you have a $500 claim, that falls within ORS 20.080. So I agree with you. I think that there was an important need to be addressed. I do think that ORS 20.080 addresses that need.
Okay. Just one more.
Yes, please.
Okay, so but I want to make sure I'm understanding, because if I'm reading this right, what the parts you mentioned in section one and in section two, unless I'm missing something, we're talking about $5,000 or less. I heard you say something about, but it could get into the hundreds of thousands. So what am I missing?
On 20.080, the fees, what I was trying to say is if you had a claim for $500, right, and you had an attorney represent you under the ORS 20.080, there's no limit on the amount of fees they could collect. So the fees could go up in the tens of thousands.
I think your question, though, I think I understand what your question was. And again, for the record, my name is Eric Van Hagen, and I'm an attorney with TriMet. Section 1 is a standalone section, and it's not tied to any other – it's not amending any other ORS provision.
Okay.
So Section 1 would stand alone, as I read it. So a mass transit district shall resolve disputes about fault in accidents involving vehicles used by the district through binding arbitration. That doesn't amend – Section 2 amends 46455, which is the small claims statute. So as a standalone, Section 1 would, as we read it, require that all fault in any accident, regardless of the scope, I think to your I think that was your question, would fall within Section 1 and be subject to binding arbitration.
Representative Springer, please.
Thank you, Madam, or Mr. Chair. I just came from another committee. Refocusing here. So, and I understand from a conversation that Representative Kenemer came to me with a little earlier, that there's some language issues in this bill. So I'm not trying to sort out those language issues right now. So I don't want my question to be distracted by those language issues, because the bill isn't where it needs to be, apparently. What percentage, because I heard a number from the Johnsons that seems a little out there, quite frankly. What percentage of claims made against TriMet do you either settle or pay out without going to court?
Definitely a high majority. I don't know the number, but I can get you that information.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Thank you. I think they mentioned 90% go to jury or something. Maybe I've got that number wrong.
It would be 90, Representative Barker and Representative, or Chair Barker and Representative Springer. It's more like we settle 90% and 10% would go to litigation.
Yeah. And it was part of the criteria of a settlement. Oftentimes that is a partial payment offer, not the full amount.
It would depend on the circumstances. Again, it property damage is a little easier to objectively determine. A lot of them involve non-economic damages, and that's more subjective. So at a certain point, it's an amount everybody agrees to. So,
Okay, thank you for that.
And may I comment on that as well?
Yes, you can, please.
Chairman Barker, Vice Chair Olson, Representative Springer. In the research I've done, when it comes to settlements across the country, oftentimes the statistics are a little bit skewed because the question often being asked is how many cases are actually making it to trial. And that number is very small, probably less than 5%, probably over the last 5 years, less than 2%. Oftentimes those statistics suggest that the other 90 to 95% of the cases are settled, which is incorrect. Probably about 60% of the cases end up settling, but the other maybe 25% or so were resolved through motion practice of one sort or another. In the trial division at the Department of Justice, for example, about 53% of the cases that we have come in are resolved through motion practice. We try to get the cases in front of the judge and get them resolved as quickly as we can, and we've been very successful in doing that. About 27% of the cases settle, and the remaining cases end up going to trial. If that helps you at all, that's some of the percentages that at least we look at the department and that we see nationwide.
Thank you for that clarification.
You bet.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Representative Krieger has a question.
Do you settle any cases in small claims, or do you force everybody to go to jury trial?
Representative Barker and Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, we see very few small claims cases. Very few. They're primarily if they're the smaller cases, it'll be ORS 2080 claims. So I can count on my hands the number of small claims that have been in the last 10 years. Very, very few.
So the process that you use is going to be more expensive for both you and the claimant?
The process through small claims is not run through the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure. So it's not a process that involves a individual's ability to investigate the claim.
Chair, follow up. Johnson case is done, but do you know who investigated that accident?
It would have been through our claims department.
Because your claims department was a Portland PD. Were they involved, or was any police agency go there?
I don't believe a police agency responded.
What would you do if a police agency did respond and then cited your driver for whatever? I mean, a obvious violation that caused the accident, and you are liable, and you should be paying without putting the public through that. Is that a policy?
No, absolutely not. We pay claims this was a case of a disputed liability, so there are plenty of claims that we've paid that we feel we are liable for.
I'm not happy with the answers. I'll just leave it at that. And I've been in this building 15 years. I'm kind of offended at what I'm hearing.
I'd like to follow that. I mean, I thought what they're saying is that they pay lots of claims without going to any court.
That's correct. I apologize if that's not been conveyed. We can get numbers for you. We pay lots of claims that we think we are liable for and do not require them to go to court to get the payment. It's well before it comes to litigation. It's in the claims department.
Thank you. Representative Weininger.
I have a question about the process. I may be misunderstanding something, but you mentioned that in Multnomah County, it's a $10,000 threshold to not be in small claims court. Did someone make a reference to that?
The $10,000, I believe, applied to ORS 2080.
Okay.
I think in Multnomah County, I don't know what the small claims cap is. I'm not sure.
Okay. I think I may be misunderstanding the situation, so just we can leave it at that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2612. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2999.
Yes, Chair Barker, members of the committee. House Bill 2999 comes to us at the request of the Committee on Judiciary. We don't have the paperwork back on this right now. There are no amendments before us today. So currently, the Oregon Tort Claims Act bars actions arising from any act or omission of a public body or an officer, employee, or agent of a public body unless proper notice of claim is given, but it does provide some exceptions. Now, during our last public hearing, we just heard about the difference between a notice of claim versus a statute of limitations. But just a friendly reminder, the notice of claims is different because that's the notice you provide to the would-be defendant within usually 180 days, 365 days after the incident or injury that is triggering the claim. A statute of limitations, on the other hand, restricts the maximum amount of time after the incident that the claim may be actually filed. So now moving to the bill, it adds a notice requirement exception for claims based on conduct constituting child abuse or knowingly allowing, permitting, or encouraging child abuse and applies to all causes of action arising before, on, or after its effective date. House Bill 2999 also revives causes of action based on conduct constituting child abuse or knowingly allowing, permitting, or encouraging child abuse if, number one, a civil action was filed before the effective date of the act, and number two, the cause of action was adjudicated based on applicable provisions in effect immediately before the effective date, as well as those based on the plaintiff's failure to comply with the statute of limitations or statute of repose. House Bill 2999 requires that revived causes of action be refiled within 2 years of its effective date.
Okay, thank you. Peter Jancy, Steve Lippold, and Kirsten, looks like Rogendorf.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
While they're coming up, can I make a comment
for
the new members of the committee? So this is a committee bill that derives, it's essentially a watered-down version of a bill brought by Representative Parrish last year that engendered lively discussion and some interesting votes that were not partisan, and it was quite interesting. But the bill really came from the former chair of this committee, the late Kelly Clark. That's a person that many of us know and as a mentor to many of us. And I just wanted to acknowledge, because there's no memorial resolution for former Representative Clark. He was kind of a pioneer in the area of child sex abuse litigation. He described it as a civil rights movement for children, which always resonated with me. And anyway, I just wanted to acknowledge that, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. You can go in any order. Please identify yourself for the record.
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today in support of HB 2999. My name is Peter Jancy. I'm a partner at the law firm of O'Donnell, Clark, and Crew. My practice focuses on advocating for victims of child sexual abuse. I testify today in support of this bill in part to honor the legacy of my late friend and mentor, Kelly Clark, who passed away unexpectedly a little over a year ago. I had the privilege of working with Mr. Clark side by side for nearly a decade doing this work, and I found him to be a man who had completely dedicated himself to the cause of justice and protection for those who cannot speak for themselves, and by that I mean vulnerable children. This cause bookended Kelly Clark's life. He took it up as a young man while he was a member of this body, and he carried it through his law practice till the end of his life. In his last years, he paid particular attention to the plight of children who are betrayed and abused in the public context, particularly those abused by foster parents, teachers, police officers, and the like. In Kelly's last days, I know that he expressed to many, and I think some of you, his hope for legislation that would remove some of the procedural obstacles from the path to justice for these types of victims. And I am very glad to see that HB 2999 is a positive step in that direction. In addition to honoring my mentor, Kelly Clark, I'd like to share an example from my own practice to highlight the importance of these types of bills. A few years ago, my law partner Steve Crew and I had a 21-year-old girl come to us. She had been born drug addicted and with serious physical disabilities. Almost from the moment of her birth, DHS was involved with monitoring her welfare. When she was 6 years old, she entered into the care of a somewhat removed relative. And when she did, DHS knew this. DHS also knew that the relative was a convicted sex offender who had been convicted for raping his own daughter. A short time later, DHS learned that this sex offender was petitioning for permanent custody of the little girl. But DHS did not take action to protect her. Instead, they paid a stipend to this convicted sex offender. Over the 4 years that followed, this little girl who became my client was repeatedly raped and exploited and tortured on an almost daily basis, and she was threatened with weapons to keep this secret. At the age of 21, she came to my office and met with my partner and I, and although we knew it would be a challenge, we agreed to represent her, and we filed a case to try to get some justice for what she had suffered. Attorneys for DHS moved to have her case thrown out based on procedural time limitations. And although she had only been an adult for a couple of years, those procedural time arguments prevented us from getting her anywhere near the justice that she deserved for what had happened to her. In the spirit of honesty and candor, I can't sit before you and tell you that HB 299 would have totally changed her case and resolved all of the issues. There are other procedural hurdles that are being faced by victims of abuse in the public context that are not addressed by this bill. But I am proud to say that HB 2999 is a positive step in the right direction. It removes one unreasonable hurdle, and in that way, it makes it a little bit easier for a child who is abused to speak out, and it moves our state closer to the day when all victims of child abuse will hear the same message, which is, no more secrets, we believe you, this wasn't your fault, and how can we help? My mentor, Kelly Clark, often said, our legal system does not guarantee justice, but it does guarantee a shot at justice. And HB 2999, yes, is a positive step towards making good on that guarantee. I've not seen an economic impact statement on this bill. I'm sure that you will. What I can say on that, and I will allow one of my colleagues to speak more on that, is that the statistics are that 90% of victims of child abuse never come forward. And regardless of what happens with this bill, the caps on damages will still apply. And I would submit to you that it is it's not the right course for us to try to protect our budget based on the suffering of children who have been abused. There is no child that I have represented who, if they had the option between a monetary award and pressing a button and having their life back would not choose the latter option. So I very much appreciate your consideration of this bill. I appreciate the bill being brought forward. I'm happy to do my best to answer any questions, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify. Thank you.
I have to leave, unfortunately, so I won't be able to hear the rest of the testimony on this, but I just want to say I think that this is a really compelling cause and really important, too, because we all know that so many people need some time to be in a position to be able to bring a claim for relief when they've been victims of abuse. So thank you for your work, and I apologize again for leaving.
Chair Barker, thank you. Representative Flinger.
Right. Again, Steve Lippold from the Department of Justice, Chairman Barker, Vice Chairman Olson, the rest of the committee. The Department of Justice is taking a neutral position on this particular bill. I came to provide you with some information should you take it into consideration. This bill does change the statute of limitations with regard to claims against the state for child abuse in that, as it currently stands under 30.275, there is a 2-year statute of limitations. The HB 2999 would create an exception to that statute, and what allows in a waiver, it provides an exception to the 2-year statute of limitations, allowing the other statute of limitations, which applies to the private sector, to come into play. That statute permits claims to be brought by a person up to the age of 40 or up to 5 years after that person discovered or reasonably should have discovered their abuse, their harm, and what have you. And so as a result of that, the statute of limitations would change. Second of all, there is a section of the statute which revives claims that have already been dismissed or are in current litigation. By the statistics that we've gone over, we've talked with DAS, which has provided us with some information indicating that over the past 8 years, there has been approximately 116 cases that have come forward of child abuse cases. We do not know what impact this statute will have. It is very difficult for us to be able to look back and determine if a person between the ages of 18 and 40 who did not have an opportunity to bring the case prior to this amendment to the statute, should it be so, could now bring a case. We are aware of at least 4 cases that were either dismissed or are on appeal on the issue of the statute of limitations. Each one of those cases has been brought under the more current statutory caps, meaning that if the plaintiff were successful in those particular claims, damages could be as much as $1.7 million or more than that, depending on the circumstances. What we have looked at this point in time is that if the trend stays the same at about 116 cases over an 8-year period, and we see, for example, a 25% increase in child abuse lawsuits brought, there would probably be a fiscal impact of about $3.5 million over those 8 years. If it's a 50% increase, it could be over $7 million. 75% increase could be as much as 11 or 13 million. We just do not have the ability to really guess in the future as to how many of those claims would come forward. So though we bring that data to the committee so they have some data of a fiscal impact, at least at this point in time.
I think Mr. Jancy mentioned before that, like, how much, what kind of a price can you put on these kind
exactly.
of things. I mean, it's very difficult. And if we extended those child abuse laws, the statute of limitations on those, so people could come in and file claims, and knowing when we did that, there would be expense. And I'm not sure why we would say, well, because it's us paying for it, we shouldn't pay for it. I mean, I have a hard time thinking. I don't want to do this because there might be more claims.
Understood.
Have to be proven. Those claims have to be proven in order to collect.
Absolutely.
Well, Mr. Chair, if you'll recall this was in 2009. I mean, Representative Barton remembers this too as well. But it started with a whole year worth of work on my part with Kelly on this, and so Peter, you'll remember that too. We ended up kind of not addressing the issue from the tort claim side. I mean, because of the potential that that, but here we are now with it. And I mean, so we're back at the table again.
Right, we are. And because at least at this point in time, a fiscal had not been put forward, we thought it'd be prudent at least to bring some data to the committee.
We appreciate that, Dan. Where are you doing that? Please, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Christian Rogendorf. In large part, my story mirrors Mr. Jancy, although I am a bit older than he is, so I have a few more years on him on that regard. But I, too, worked with Kelly Clark. I worked with him starting in 2000. I'm here to talk to you today about three things. Number one, Kelly. I'll give you a little bit of background, not only on him, but on why this issue was A, important to him, and B, why this continues his legacy. Number two, the couple of cases, just brief summaries to show why the problems are such large problems in the context of child abuse. Notice in the statute of limitations go beyond simple technical aspects in cases like these and often completely bar children who were abused from any recovery at all. And finally, I'd like to just discuss the technical aspects of this bill briefly and see if there's any questions I can answer. First, let me touch on Kelly. I knew Kelly since 2000. I worked with him for 13 years, and then I went off on my own. He, with his blessing, he was a good man. He did what he could to help children. But he didn't start out that way, at least not as a lawyer. He started out in this building, as has been pointed out, and he passed 12117. Or yeah, actually helped doing it. And of course, anything in the legislature is team effort. But he helped do that. And that singular bill opened up an entire avenue that was closed to victims of child abuse. The ability to bring suit is almost as important as recovery in these sorts of cases. For children who've been abused, it is a brutal, brutal awakening for them to come to court or come to even a lawyer's office and hear, "I'm sorry, I believe you were abused, and there's nothing I can do to help you." Kelly didn't like that. I don't like it. I know Peter doesn't like it. None of us are happy with that result, and I don't think anyone in the committee is. The problem is that the Oregon Tort Claims Act puts those barriers in place quite intentionally. And over the years, the case law has only gone ahead and bolstered those barriers. But when Kelly helped pass 12117, he did it not because it was going to help his business, not because it was going to help get his firm off the ground. He didn't have a firm like that at that point. He was a legislator, and before his political star fell to earth, he had no plans on doing this. But he got that law passed because it was the right thing to do. And I advocate to you today that I think it's still the right thing to do, especially in the context of the Tort Claims Act. Now, as to the cases, there's a couple cases that sort of bookend my own career. One was early in 2002 that I worked on with Kelly, and the other is one that I'm currently working on, and it's one of the ones that are that's on appeal, as the DOJ representative mentioned. Now, we have the first case had to do with, without going into the details terribly much, had to do with a young child who was in foster care in Oregon. He was given to a foster father who took him to California and essentially treated him as a sex slave. We felt that this was obviously a horrible injustice. We wanted to help this young man. He was only in his early 20s at the time. But even though he was so young, when he came to us, there was literally nothing we could do. We filed suit, we fought, we lost, we tried to appeal, we lost. The fact is that the way the Tort Claims Act is structured now, the only way a child abuse victim will ever see any justice whatsoever in the civil arena is if they immediately report. As Mr. Jancy mentioned, the fact is children don't report this. Most of them don't, ever. They'll take it to their graves. It's a very, very difficult thing to ever admit, not only that as a child you were hurt sexually, but that you were taken advantage of. And in these cases, taken advantage of by someone you trusted, needed, and in many cases loved. The Tort Claims Act, though, also has in case also applies in cases currently, even on children who are still minors. The case I'm currently involved in, the appeal, involves a young boy who, at the time he was abused, age 7 in 2010. He was abused by a man who was living in his biological mother's home, and he was, by the time he reported it in 2013, arguably the notice provision and statute of limitations had run. The state managed to get that case dismissed. This man had over 43 calls to DHS about his behavior with his own children and with our client. These are the kinds of things, these fundamental injustices are the kinds of things that corrode the system that we hold so dear. When we go ahead and we tell the victims that they can't get relief, even minors, even children, he's still 10 years old or 12 years old now, and he still can't get justice. And the reason being goes to the technical aspects of this bill. Currently, the Tort Claims Act has a very strict notice provision, and the notice provision is 6 months from the time of injury. Now, we, Kelly and I, got a case against Lake Oswego School District several years ago, and that was the Oregon Supreme Court recognized that if the child doesn't perceive an injury, then perhaps the notice and statute of limitations are told. Well, that's a pretty high bar because, you know, child abuse isn't often something you just sort of gloss over. For a lot of these kids, they can't talk about it, but it's certainly nothing that they would ever consider to be minor. What happens is because of that six-month notice period, which is extended 3 months for minors, 270 days later, if the child did not enjoy, and I use that term very advisedly, his abuse or her abuse, they're barred forever from bringing a claim, no matter what the negligence of the state was, no matter what the negligence of any municipality, hospital, or other entity that is tied to the Tort Claims Act, no matter what their particular liability is, there's no claim at all. And that right there is the fundamental thing that this bill, House Bill 2999, changes. It goes ahead and incorporates that unique child abuse statute of limitations that Kelly helped pass back in 1989. That child abuse statute of limitations recognizes that when a child is abused, the abuse itself doesn't start the clock running. Because in all the years I've done this, in the 15 years that I've been working on these cases, there have been a handful of cases where the individual who was abused forgot. It happens, and it happens, the worse the abuse is, the more often it happens. But those are the very rare cases. So what we're talking about is in probably 98, 99% of the cases of child abuse, of those who can come forward, which is still just a sliver, they're barred from any claim because they could remember their abuse. By going ahead and separating the abuse from the injury, as 12117 does, this bill allows a child abuse victim who was victimized by an agent of the state to go ahead and bring suit, not when they realize that they were abused, but when they realize that that abuse actually had a sustained impact on their life. That is a huge boon to the victims bar, or to the victims groups, that will be able to go ahead and allow them to seek that justice, which isn't guaranteed, but it allows them to at least seek it. Now, the other aspect that the representative from the Department of Justice mentioned was that it also amends the statute of limitations. I'm going to let the courts weigh in on that. I don't know if it's entirely clear, but I don't know necessarily if it's not. To be honest, it's somewhat of an open question, and it's an issue that maybe or maybe not is something that would concern you. However, one of the things that is clear is that any abuse that did happen prior to the 2009 amendments to the Tort Claims Act is covered by the $250,000 cap that was in place at the time of the abuse, of any abuse prior to 2009. That should not have a financial impact that would influence, I believe, your decisions. And I think that the lack of financial impact in those cases, which are the cases that are really the ones that are probably the most important from the standpoint of when is the child actually going to be able to come forward. Those old cases are what we want to go ahead, I think, and capture in bringing forward and allowing those victims to seek that justice. It's absolutely right that it's not a guarantee. It's absolutely right that they have to prove their case. But in so many cases, that avenue is foreclosed. And I would just simply urge you, in my strongest possible terms, to go ahead and please, please pass this bill as the first step for healing for those victims. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Anybody else here testify on this bill? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2019. Any further business to come before the committee? Thank you.